Welcome to the 37th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
I'm Toby Chat.
England are collapsing gate spin, Bangladesh are losing, and we've another episode of Reverse Threat Radio for you. There are some things in life you can truly rely on.
Beauty! Yes! Magnificent cricket!
And it's quite nice that the natural order has been restored and that we've got all kinds of cricket going on all over the world, and having three test series to follow simultaneously.
It's been quite exciting, hasn't it? This sort of super week where you're suddenly, the Crick Info feed is buzzing again.
Yeah.
Twitter is alive with banter of assorted quality.
And suddenly in November it feels rather more manageable. I was actually particularly heartened by Bangladesh's performance, and that may seem odd because we're recording about an hour after they've lost the first test.
Tino Best has taken his five for 24.
I mean, that's pretty. It's not Steve Harmison in the West Indies, but it's guessing that. But I was very heartened by the fact that Bangladesh were able to score big runs in the first innings. It's only the seventh time in all the tests that they've ever played that they've had a lead on first innings. Would you believe it?
I would believe it, actually.
Well, okay, fair enough. And it just seems to me that one of the things that they've always really struggled with is having the... they've had people who can gouse and score quick-fire centuries, but to actually put together a big score, albeit on a fairly placid pitch, is, I think, a good sign. And despite the fact that Tino Best is... obviously, back to his best. I mean, I didn't really want to say that, but Tino Best is obviously back to somewhere near his best. And obviously, they ended up collapsing all out in 55 overs in their second innings. But I think just the fact that they can compile big scores, even when the pitch is for them, is really important. Yeah. It's going to be psychologically quite important.
I slightly feel like we're scraping the barrel a little bit. I mean. I think we've all got to the stage where we're desperate for Bangladesh to show signs of life and signs of improvement. But unfortunately, the reality is they did get themselves into a decent position in this test, and yet they failed to just see it through. I mean, even a draw here would have been, a very respectable result. At the same time, they actually had a gettable chase here.
They were only 77 runs short, and there was a time when it looked even when I was watching some of it. This morning there was a time with three wickets in hand, Marmadullah still in, that it looked slightly guessable. And yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they did roll over
this,
in the end.
This match certainly provided my highlight of the last fortnight, whereby Chris Gayle became the first batsman in Test match history to dispatch the first ball of the game for a six. Gayle's certainly not the greatest batsman of his generation, but he may well go down as the one who's had the greatest impact on how the game's played, I feel. I mean, he just consistently does things that no one has ever really considered.
I'm not sure why... It's interesting, because he's the one who makes the big statement that falls out with the board and then does things like hitting first balls of matches for six and everything like that. I mean, the fact that he went on to score fewer than 50 runs, I think, in the entire game, when there were however many over 1,000 scored within the match.
He likes the challenge. There was no challenge to be had there.
No, there wasn't. Scoring a century when everyone else is scoring a century is just a bit...
Very tedious.
A bit passé. The thing that slightly worries me about Gayle is that there are six hitters like... I mean, Sehwag is a topical one, but you're also going to think of people like Adam Gilchrist, who actually would use their six hitting a bit more sensibly.
Mm.
And absolutely, it's quite impressive to be able to hit a six of the first ball of a test match, etc., etc. But ultimately, it's all swagger and no...
Well, this I think, is where I like the swagger. I like Gayle's casual arrogance, and I actually think it's something that, frankly, I entirely agree with you. West Indies won this test because of the excellence of Kieran Powell in particular,
yep.
and Shiv Chanderpaul as ever. But they need that. I mean, when the West Indies were at their best, there was something to do. There was that belief in Arians. And just, it says something extraordinary about Gayle's mentality that you could even consider doing that. And that sort of mentality, although we'd like to translate it into runs, is the kind of thing I think the West Indies need.
Sloppy, has been ordinary, has been poor. Some people would call it rubbish.
It seems ridiculous to me that you send out your worst batsman at a point when the... person who comes in after the Night Watchman is going to be in so much more pressure than the Night Watchman would have been in the first place.
I mean, I think there was interesting debate going on Twitter about this, and I didn't really see anyone justifying it. I think the issue is that putting the Night Watchman in a position which they're just, that even a really capable batsman would struggle in, just doesn't really seem very logical. I mean, giving Anderson five overs in fading light on a turning pitch against Smith, it seemed suicidal. And I mean, I felt sorry for the guy. He's a good batsman. I mean, he's a good batsman for a tail ender. He's got very intelligent defence. But he failed to do the job because he simply wasn't equipped for it. And I mean, it said a lot that Jonathan Trott then went in and got out.
Well, it's just this mentality, isn't there? The mentality of Night Watchman is kind of the dumb thing, even when it's not particularly appropriate. And there's always this thing about you lose one wicket, you might lose another. But certainly, if you lose two wickets, you're pretty likely to lose three by the same
It'd be interesting whether the Anderson failure forces a rethink amongst England on this. I mean, my real sort of sad moment of the last couple of weeks, and it was sad, actually involved a rugby ball on a cricket pitch where JP Duminy, after, you know, a good day's cricket for South Africa, ended up injuring himself in a sort of post-match rugby warm-down game. And I get the fact that it's a bit of fun for the players and they want to, but the reality is the stakes here are so high. I mean, they're professional sportsmen, their careers rely on their physical health. And, you know, it's not like we haven't seen this before. I mean, we think of kind of, we've had these incidents before, please, playing these.
McGrath, that was one of those, that stray cricket ball. Yeah. I mean, at least that was a cricket ball rather than a rugby ball.
But we've had this before, and I just feel like there's a real need to just take this a little bit more seriously, I think. And there's a real tragedy here because Duminy's at a stage in his career where he can kind of ill afford to just lose 6 months. South Africa's the kind of side with the kind of strength where if he loses his place, he may well not get it back.
But then I suppose the question is always where the balance lies and how far actually doing things which are extraneous to cricket are necessary. Because actually going to the gym is, I mean, I've never been to a gym in my entire life, so I wouldn't know, but I'd imagine that going to that, and this is my excuse why going to a gym is probably, in a sense, quite dangerous. I'm sure you can do yourself an injury somehow there. But that actually, if you were to cut all cricketers off from all kinds of other activities from which they can actually potentially learn a lot. I mean, I just get the sense that there are two or three, whenever it happens, there's a great big fuss made over it, but it doesn't actually happen all that often. For the number of cricketers who warm up with a rugby ball, the portion of them who get injured while doing it must be absolutely tiny.
I see very few footballers that warm up by bowling at 90 miles an hour at each other.
From the archives, in this episode, Andy is going to give the final word on the curious tale of Mark Ravin Ramprakash.
I feel like me and Ramprakash go back a bit. I grew up watching a lot of my cricket at the Oval and Lords, and I always seem to be watching Ramprakash make 100. And it seems strange until later on I kind of realised, well, that was inevitable. If you go to the Oval, if you go to Lords, you were going to watch Ramprakash make 100s. It's just what he did. And what a sight it was, you know, and what an extraordinary player he was, an extraordinary stroke player. And finally, this summer, at the age of 42, he's finally retired from first-class cricket. What was a bit sad about it was he wasn't actually able to make the decision on his own terms. He had wanted to play on, but Surrey coach Chris Adams had made quite clear he no longer saw a long-term role for Rams. And it was interesting. It inevitably provided a flurry of judgments, and you had someone who's being described as both the greatest county batsman of his generation and also a great unfulfilled talent.
It's one of those interesting careers where you sort of want it to have a very clear end point. And you want there to be a moment where he goes out having scored his 100th, if that was a possible
one. And that would have been the finale.
You know, if he had been recalled instead of Jonathan Trott for that final Ashes test at the Oval in his home ground, that could have been the end. You know, to have that definitive ending would be very sad.
It's somehow appropriate for Ramprakash that it was a slightly messy ending, but somehow sad as well for someone who'd served Surrey in particular so well. I mean, we're dealing with an extraordinary prodigy here. Aged 18, he guided Middlesex to victory in the 1988 NatWest Trophy final. It was his first ever 50-over outing. That's the kind of player we were dealing with. And there's a general consensus around him by most people sort of play that he was stylistically, technically, the most gifted English batsman of his generation. which is why there's almost no debate that a test average of 27.3 simply doesn't reflect the talent he had.
It's interesting. I mean, when he made, so he was man of the match in 1988, which was the year I was born. I'm just trying to think if there are any other possible cricketers who have been playing consistently at a high level throughout our life.
It's a good question. It would be a very
what
short
list. What the hell have I achieved in the last 23 years? Certainly not as
it's
much
a nice
as
way. It's a nice way of putting it, actually. But the interesting thing is, once you accept that 27.3 simply does not reflect the ability he had, the potential he had, you then got to ask why. And the standard Ram Prakash explanation is Ram Prakash was mentally weak. I've always found this a little bit unsatisfactory as an explanation, because it doesn't seem to provide a full picture. This was a guy with a ferocious intensity, simply didn't tolerate failure. There are fantastic stories about this. Evening Standard journalist David Lloyd talked about the fact that after a soft dismissal in South Africa, he saw Ram Prakash out on the pitch on his own, just skipping for sort of minutes on end. It was a kind of like, he described it as almost like a kind of self-flagellation.
Skipping is a pretty harmless way of self-flagellation.
Yeah, I suppose, in terms of ways. Also, a lot of talk from teammates about how dressing rooms took a lot of damage after a Ram Prakash dismissal. Also, a kind of bizarre quote from Ram Prakash himself, how he would go around the dressing room checking other teammates' bats to make sure no one had anything better than himself. And it's something Ram Prakash himself is actually quite defensive about. He actually said, well, look, there's nothing wrong. He basically said, why would you question, why should I apologise for being highly motivated, for wanting to be the best I can be? You know, this is a sort of direct quote from
Ram Prakash. But you do wonder whether there's something which is verging on the neurotic in that kind of behaviour that can't be particularly healthy when it comes to the inevitably, when you are playing at the top level of any sport, you're going to fail from time to time. And if every single time you fail, it turns into this kind of web of either sort of criticising yourself or blaming others about it. It can't be a particularly healthy
And writer. I think this is the difficulty, because I think such an intensity is often going to be the mark of a great sportsman. That sort of intensity, that sort of demand. But sadly, in Ram Prakash's case, it seemed to get to a stage where it restricted the formidable talent he certainly had. And I entirely agree that there was a balance there. And he never kind of managed to get that balance quite right.
Mm. Well, I suppose when you're putting so much pressure on yourself, the pressure of international sport on top of that must be...
Well, there's a kind of fascinating question, though, is whether it was changeable. Can you change that aspect of your personality? Because, you know, people do change, and cricketers do change. And, I mean, you certainly see players who seem to be able to tame certain parts of their personality that they need to.
Ram Prakash, like Kevin Peter, look at his ethos recently.
Quite. Well, Ram Prakash argued himself when it came down to that trot recall. He said, look, I'm not the same person I was. I'm older, I'm more experienced. Sadly, we'll never know. Mm. He never got that sort of chance later on. But it's an interesting question to ask, well, did Ram Prakash fail to change something about himself that could have been changed, or was he effectively cursed with a mentality? I increasingly, the more I think about it, the more I read about it, I err on the latter. I don't know whether it was something so much about him, I don't know whether it was ever changeable. Ever.
So do you... So when you say about that trot recall in the... last test of the 2009 Ashes.
Yes.
So Ram Prakash publicly came out and said, I'm a different person, you should pick me because I'm...
He was very open about the fact that he was saying, you know, he'd scored, you know, over 6,000 runs in county cricket over the previous four seasons. He said, I'm just not the same player. And he had, what's interesting that I wasn't aware of, there were very serious conversations taking place between Ram Prakash and the selectors. I mean, he was in their thoughts. It wasn't as kind of simple as that. But in the end, they obviously came to the decision that it was wrong to look back. It was wrong to look back, and I think
rightly, I think actually, because when you look at how trust is
sure, and they were and they were justified by the decision. But as you said yourself, maybe sad in a sense of, you know, it would have been nice to see, you know, was he a different man than the man who fell before? The other argument away from his mentality has been this idea that Ram Prakash was a victim of a flawed system, kind of similar to Graham Hick. There's an interesting quote from Duncan Fletcher, who said, I wish I'd had him and Hick as youngsters in the England setup. I just would never have dropped them. And this point of natural ability being nurtured rather than constantly dropped, brought back in, put under pressure. And I think there's a great Ian Bell comparison here. How long were we talking about Ian Bell as the most technically talented batsman in England without him living up to his reputation? And England have made him work.
Yep.
You know, they brought him through. And there's an interesting question to ask. Several ex-England captains, actually, Vaughan and Hussain, have both gone on record saying Ram Prakash would have done so much better, you know, under the current setup today. Mm. And I think, so there's a responsibility that goes beyond that, that sort of goes beyond himself.
But but I wonder whether you can say that you can just transplant a system from the... You're essentially talking the kind of mid-2000s, when England were playing very well, and take it back to a time when England were getting roundly thrashed, they didn't have the players available, and actually sticking with someone who wasn't firing and keeping them in a team that was, frankly, pretty appalling, how beneficial that... The thing about Ian Bell is that he has played in a successful team, and he's been playing alongside batsmen who are very, very good, and England, on the most part, have been able to accommodate, in a sense, his failures, whereas with Ram Prakash... England basically needed every single run they could get their hands on in international cricket,
You're quite right, and there are two sort of important kind of caveats there. The fact that, firstly, Ram Prakash got 52 tests. He cannot claim not to have had a shot. He was brought in and out a lot, he was shuffled in and out a lot, it wasn't sort of consistent, but he has to look at the fact that he did get sort of 52 test matches as a player. I think the other idea here as well, any England player from that mid-90s side would have done better in the 2000 setup. Yep. I think we can all agree with that. I mean, I suppose with someone like Alex Stewart. You know, how well did Alex Stewart do for England under poor management? You know, how well would he...
This whole career of Ram Prakash has just been... It's just one massive what-if. All the way through. What if he'd been in a different setup? What if he'd been given a chance? What if he'd been recalled in 2009?
Well, a fascinating what-if that I was entirely unaware of before researching this piece was the fact that Ram Prakash was interviewed quite seriously along with Nasser Hussain for the captaincy. And I had just never been aware that Ram Prakash... And it is a fascinating what-if. I mean, had Ram Prakash been put in charge of that, what effect would that have had? I mean, would that be... You know, it's really... Interestingly, the report suggested that his interview lasted barely 5 minutes... whereas Hussain was talking about his sort of vision for the side for over an hour. So, you know, didn't seem to even come close. A sort of final kind of afterthought on all of this. So we've talked about kind of maybe why it didn't work for a player of extraordinary talent. You know, why it didn't work at international level. It really did work at county level. And it's this idea of trying to live with underachievement. Because I thought there was something incredibly sad that his retirement was greeted with so many articles, so many comments. I thought this one summed it up very well from Nasser Hussain. He was a world-class player, or should have been. We've got another one from Evening Standard journalist, again, David Lloyd. You play the cards you're dealt, and Ram Prakash could and should have used his hand a lot better. And my feeling is, what must it be to be a sportsman who's committed in such a serious way for 20 years and to have to live with that sense of underachievement and feel... And the recent sort of interviews I've seen with Ram Prakash and the way he played at Surrey, actually, over the last few years in career... suggested to me that he'd managed to make peace with that. And I
that's
actually...
interesting. Was his county cricket disinterested in the sense that did he just go out and score centuries for Surrey and that's all he wanted to do? Or was he always scoring centuries scoring centuries for Surrey is not an easy thing to say. Was he always scoring centuries for Surrey and doing it because was the motivation always that he might get back into the England side?
I think that was part of it for a long time. But I think, and again, this is hard to give a definite answer on this, and I'm not even sure whether Ram Prakash himself will be able to give a clear answer to this, but I think his success with Surrey and the sort of more, almost a relaxation crept into the way he played the game and a more sort of his natural talent came out. And I just got the feeling that he was less worried, and even when he retired, he could be proud of his achievements. And I think, actually, that's something I personally have a huge amount of respect for, is the fact that he's ended up having to live with something very difficult. Living with this idea of being everyone's great, unfulfilled talent is hard. And I think he's managed that. And I think he's, in the end, been able to achieve a lot in the county game and been proud of that achievement. And I think that's something that we should respect. To the review, and this episode we're looking at Behind the Boundary, Cricket at a Crossroads by Graham Wright. Wright's mission was essentially to study county cricket, and it was built on his belief that he felt there was something fundamentally very, very wrong with it and how it was working. So in many ways, this is a study of cricket as a business concern, like how great it can continue to function financially. And I mean, his findings are, I'm not sure if they're shocking, because I think sadly many of these he sort of discovers are problems we're kind of aware of, but the sort of scale of the problems there are considerable.
He very interestingly talks and gathers evidence and shows in a new light some of what I think are the fundamental issues around county cricket that have never quite been addressed. And this is published in 2011, and he sort of brings them very much up to date. And one of the really interesting things that he starts off by talking about and then talks about throughout the book is exactly the way in which Test cricket and county cricket, or international cricket and county cricket, interact. And this whole question about whether counties were called for a while centres of excellence.
Mm.
The idea being that they would produce players for the county game. Now the reality is that Test players never play county cricket, that the ECB puts demands on counties in order to get cricketers to then play in Tests, which don't actually allow the counties in and of themselves to thrive. So they're sort of pulled in two directions at the same time.
And I think this key point comes really with the grounds as well. And there's this interesting idea, whose fault was it that there was this great big rush towards so many grounds looking for international status? And I think Wright quite persuasively makes the case that the ECB has a lot of responsibility in this case. Yes, some of the counties were silly, they were irresponsible, they aimed higher, they went beyond their resources, but they were encouraged to do so by the ECB. Particularly, the ECB was open about the fact they wanted to break the dominance of the senior grounds, the kind of Oval, Lords, Headingley, Old Trafford, and they wanted competition.
But it's this kind of idea that there seems to be that everyone should... That the perfect example of a county ground is that it should also host Test matches.
Mm.
Which seems to me to be flawed on so many levels. Personally, I can't think of anything nicer than going down to Arundel and sitting under the castle and watching county cricket, but that's never going to be a Test ground, and it's a good thing.
And Wright does actually make the point that several of the grounds have done well, and he really uses Chelmsford and Essex as an example of a really well-run ground, because he said, look, they were honest about that. They were never going to bring international cricket there, so they just ran a really good county operation.
What runs through the book is the fact that within this sort of ecosystem of county cricket, that the individuality of each county is enormous, and that they can never be lumped together. And one of the problems with the ECB is that the ECB sees the counties as this group of sort of like-for-like organisations that can all be run in the same way. There's an absolutely fair... I mean, I very, very rarely find summaries of accounts interesting, but there's a really interesting summary of the turnover and gate receipts of all of the counties. And I'm not sure whether... I mean, it has a slight caveat at the bottom saying that every county accounts differently. But the fact that Glamorgan, in 2009, took £6 million in gate receipts, whilst Derbyshire took £164,000 in gate receipts, is just absolutely extraordinary. And I think it's just a really graphic reminder of the fact that we talk about a county system, but that in reality, actually, every single county is so different from one another that...
And this distinction between the haves and the have-nots is something that kind of every sport has to some extent. But I think what's interesting, that there's a quote at some point in the book where it talks about how, look, 18 counties, so few people accept that if you design the game from scratch, that's the number. You know, people say, we've ended up with that, and that's what we're going to have to manage.
Yep.
And there does seem to be this odd acceptance that 18 is too many, but we can't really reduce it.
Do away with it. There are obvious ones for the chat.
We often read, sort of a lot of the books we review are kind of quite romantic interpretations of cricket, and it was quite, I found it quite sort of, to use a massive cliche, it was a real cold dose of reality, this book. This is a very brutal book. I mean, it's about, as you were just talking, you know, it's about the accounts, really. I thought a very pertinent quote from, well, in many ways, kind of the recent saviour of Hampshire cricket, Rod Bransgrove, who basically talked about how domestic cricket is not a commercially viable business.
Mm.
You know, he just said that's evident. And it's a very scary statement when you say that and you accept that.
There's an interesting section about, which I think is one of the fundamental problems with county cricket, and goes back exactly to that quotation, which is the fact that we all have in our in our minds the idea that the perfect way for a county to be run would be for it to have the kind of the people who are the 10 men and their one dog that turn up to every single game in May when it's and sit through all the rain delays. We sort of think of those as the core audience of counties, and that if there were just more of them, that counties would be able to survive. But actually, the reality is that the target audience for the cricket, for cricket's sake, is very, very different from the target audience that will actually make them commercially viable businesses. Mm. And that actually, it's Lancashire, isn't it, who take a ridiculous amount of money through doing things that aren't cricket.
It was hilarious, and actually kind of sad that there was this reference to how actually Lancashire made a huge amount of its money through hosting concerts. And there's this quote that looks at how, you know, when you look at their conference work, the fact they offer car parking for when Manchester United play at home, the quote suggests, well, you might wonder why Lancashire bother with cricket at all. And it's interesting that you find a lot of clubs in this situation where cricket's kind of the loss leader. You know, they're desperate to do other stuff to kind of support the cricket.
Well, it is, but then that's how, in a sense, you would run the business viably, would be to say, okay, so we want to... I work for a charity, and this is a lot of the way that, you know, all organisations that sort of lose money have to think, which is the stuff that we really want to do loses money, so how do we do stuff that also makes money but maintain the integrity of that central thing, which is the loss maker, but have these sort of viable exercises that go on around it? And it's that balance that is so difficult.
And Wright does ask a couple of sort of chairmen and chief executives at one stage, he asks them, well, look, are you running a cricket team or a business? And he does get disparate answers, and it's interesting. And obviously it's a slightly binary and unhelpful question. But the point is that without it being run sort of professionally as a business, that the cricket is just it becomes unsupportable.
To the interview, and this week I was lucky enough to speak to John Hotton of the excellent The Old Batsman blog. I started off by asking John for his thoughts on the current state of cricket journalism.
And I actually think it's rather good. I mean, I think it's easy to say and easy to kind of look back on some sort of other golden age that maybe actually never really existed. But I think that online in particular has been a great boon for cricket. And especially if you think about it, even county cricket, you know, when the Guardian sort of intimated that they might close their county cricket blog, there was uproar amongst this community that had grown up reading it day to day. And, you know, that's a kind of offshoot of the over by over things that came out on the, you know, on the newspaper websites and so on. I mean, there's Crickinfo, which is probably, I'd say, the greatest website in the world in a way. I mean, it's the only place you can go that will essentially answer you any question on that subject. I mean, it's quite a remarkable piece of work when you think about it.
Yeah, it is extraordinary, just its size and the amount of stuff that's on it.
I mean, you can ask it anything and it will tell you. I mean, it's hard to think of another website about a subject that is like that. It's an astonishing piece of work. So, I mean, there's that, and there's, you know, I think obviously, you know, the modern world, in a way, has become atomised, and so there are smaller and smaller compartments for everything. And you would say that, you know, your frontline cricket correspondent of a particular paper, his role has become smaller, and there are less of them. And so, from that point of view, that's probably not a great thing. But the clamour of voices from everywhere else is such that it makes me think the future's actually in a very good place.
I was going to say, because there's that interesting balance, isn't there? Because it's that point that there do seem to be fewer, particularly at the county level, that the papers seem to commit fewer writers to that. And yet, in the internet, you've got many, many more voices.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think it's almost balanced itself out in that respect?
It almost does. I mean, you know, you're not going to get that old sort of telegraph thing of having a reporter at every county game. I mean, they'd be lucky if they knew when they all started. Yeah. And until they do it next year when we're all starting on a Sunday or something bizarre. But I think, you know, it's just I think it's a frequency argument as much as anything else. I mean, people don't pick up a daily paper in the morning to find out the scores anymore because the scores are everywhere. You don't need to wait till tomorrow. You can find out what's happening this ball, you know. So in a way, that role has kind of become negated, and we're sort of waiting to see what takes its place. And I think what's taking its place is this sort of, again, the, you know, these varied voices from all the different grounds, you know, whether that's on Twitter, whether that's on Quick Info, whether that's on the Guardian site, or whatever it is, or the blogs, whatever.
Are you generally impressed, I mean, with the quality of the blogs? Because it seems that there does seem to be quite a lot of sort of differing opinions on that. Some people say, oh, you know, the blog is full of good writing. Other people sort of feel that it's that there's a lot of opinions maybe and not always that much substance. I mean, are you generally impressed with what you read and what you
think? I mean, I think that is an important point. And that strikes at what kind of quality of reporting are you going to get? I mean, obviously, you know, journalism is different to blogging vastly. And, you know, blogging, I think, should be about opinion and it should be about individual voices. It can't replace that kind of hard-nosed journalism that exists elsewhere. So the two have to exist side by side. And I think there's been some very good reporting about cricket. You know, you have to look at the various match-fixing scandals that have gone on, or other things. I don't know, but there's still good, solid cricket reporting that goes on, and there are still the guy, the stringer, who goes down after the day's play and gets you the quotes that you want to hear. So, you know, that's important as well. The blogs kind of have a different role. So I don't necessarily think, although there is quality writing on there, quality writing is the point of them always. You know, it doesn't always have to be.
Well, that's an interesting distinction to make. Well, because it leads me on kind of what I really wanted to ask next, which is what sort of inspired you to create The Old Batsman? Because I'm not just sort of, this isn't just kind of a cheap compliment, but I do feel like on The Old Batsman, your posts consistently feel, they feel like they've been thought through and written as much as essays, which is, you know, it's quite different to a lot of the blog posts you get where you feel like it's kind of a very brief sort of spur-of-the-moment response to something that's happened.
Yeah.
A lot of your posts, both in kind of length and the way they're thought through. So I just wondered kind of what kind of inspired you to kind of create that sort of a blog?
Well, I suppose, it's very kind, thank you. I mean, I suppose what it was I was kind of becoming one of those, two things, right? I was becoming one of those people who just sat in the living room shouting at the telly, you know, and that becomes boring after a while. And I sort of thought, I mean, I work as a writer, and I didn't ever want to write about cricket because that was my thing, you know, that was my kind of thing that I did when I didn't want to think about all that other stuff. But it sort of eventually drove me slightly crazy not doing it, I suppose, and having something to say. And the other thing was that I really naively thought one day, just before I started, oh, I wonder if there are any blogs about cricket, you know, and I entered into a search, and all of a sudden all of these, you know,
millions
of
users.
Yeah, and it was brilliant. And obviously the first one I read was Cricket with Balls, and I remember really clearly it was about, it was at the time of the ICL, the ill-fated Pakistani response to the IPL. And Jared had written this hilarious thing about one of the teams, and I remember Mohammed Yusuf was playing for them. And he's written this great post about it, and I thought, you know, this is absolutely kind of what I had in mind. And I realised straight away I couldn't do that because that's not my thing. You know, he's got a very individual voice, and that's one of the great boons of the blogs, is that a voice like that, that's probably the only way a voice like his is ever going to emerge into the mainstream. And that's through the blogs, and that's partly why they're so important. But also I thought, well, you know, I can kind of say what I've got to say in the way I want to, and I sort of deliberately steered clear of not obvious subjects, but, you know, not what's just happened today, because I think, you know, to take a kind of tangential approach, again, is one of the great joys of blogging. If you write for a living, you kind of find it's a very prescriptive thing. It's this many words on this day at this time about this subject that you've talked about before. Well, I think the whole point of blogging is to go off at those tangents and approach it.
I mean, you are your own master, aren't you? Whatever you want.
Exactly, yeah. And I think the reason, if there is good writing on blogs, which I'm sure there is, part of that is that, you know, it's not a word length, it's not a word count. It's say what you've got to say and get off, you know.
Yeah.
And that kind of does lead to a bit of strength in writing, I think, when you've not got to waffle to 1,000 words or keep it to 200 words.
I mean,
words,
do you think there's something about cricket as a sport, though, that lends itself? Because, I mean, I remember one of your posts quite recently, I think it was titled Saj Mahmood and the Infinite Sadness, and I remember thinking that sort of, it was kind of like almost a sort of philosophical title. And I mean, what you then wrote, you know, it was really interesting. And I was thinking, I was wondering kind of, whether there's something about cricket as a sport that really lends itself to that kind of journal, is that kind of blogging, that subject, which maybe other sports wouldn't. You know, cricket can kind of be taken seriously, perhaps, as a sport in a way some of the sports.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true to a degree, although I'm sure that is coming in other sports. I mean, it's a kind of sporting thing. There is that, you know, it's a great saying about Muhammad Ali, and I suppose boxing's done this more than cricket. You know, there's, I think it was Norman Mailer wrote about Muhammad Ali, men die twice, you know. And that's it's a great, what he meant was that, you know, they die once as sportsmen and once again as men, you know, and it's because it's over so early in your life, this kind of, you know, sporting moment that you have, and then it's very difficult to replace it after that. And I think that, you know, that's where that kind of you know, sense of unfulfillment you get from that, or that difficulty to replace something that you've loved so much. That's where that kind of sadness comes from, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, there's the more general point you're making about cricket. It's a reflective sport. To me, it's always been an internal sport. The genius of the game is its psychology, not necessarily the rules or any of that. Although all of those things are great, and the dimensions of it are great. The absolute genius of cricket is that you only get one chance. You know, as a batsman, you go in, and if you're out, that's it. It can be your test match debut. It can be something you've worked for all your life, and many people are, can be out first ball. And that's it. It's this kind of shattering certainty that it produces. And I think that the whole psyche of cricket, to me, is built around that moment. And you can kind of extrapolate out from that everything about the psyche of the people that play it. I think this notion, and I was just writing something about it a minute ago, I was writing something about Andrew Flintoff and boxing.
Yeah.
And I think certain people, you know, there's that great book by David Frith, Silence of the Heart, about people in cricket who've committed suicide. And it's this kind of internalization of the game and the people that it draws to it, I think, that leads to that kind of reflective side of it that you're talking about.
I think you've leading on to another point, because we spend a lot of time on the podcast talking, you know, reviewing books, and I think it's really interesting you bring boxing into, because I think, I mean, boxing's got its own very good sort of special literature, but cricket just seems to have, it produces such an extraordinary amount of just really, really well-written books on such varied topics, and you do look at certain other sports and you think there's just nothing quite comparable.
Doesn't quite do it, yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose it's partly a publishing argument, you know, if they sell and people will publish them, you know. In football, there's not really the market for that sort of thing. You know, it's either the plodding, thudding autobiography or the fan memoir, and that's all they ever seem to get to. Yeah. You know, I don't know why. I mean, maybe there's just not the market for that. Maybe there's not the depth in the game. You know, although people sort of call it the beautiful game, maybe it's sort of slightly shallow game. You know, I don't really know. I don't really know enough about other sports to say, really. And boxing certainly has that. Boxing certainly has always...
It does say something interesting about cricket, the fact that it can get the attention of good writers for that long. It suggests there's something about it. I just wondered, sort of focusing on the kind of things you look at on the blog. Sorry, I've got a bit of a cough, which is going to keep jumping up. But you often write, you sort of take cricket from the past, and you write often with quite a lot of passion about it. And I wonder if you ever find yourself kind of pining for the game as it was, and kind of thinking a bit, actually, kind of as you were saying with the journalism, that you kind of would like things to be more like they were, that there was maybe more of a golden era in cricket that we're not quite in now. Or...
No, I don't know. No, I actually don't. I really don't. Although I kind of like, you know, that... The past is just if you're writing about cricket, the past is just the great reference point that you've got, isn't it? You know, the game has been going on for so long, almost everything has kind of happened in one way or another, so you can make mention of it. And, you know, the notion of completed lives, you know, the sort of your current players, we don't know what's going to happen to KP or Michael Clarke or Ricky Ponting or any of those, but you know what happened to Grace, you know what happened to Bradman, you know, their story has more of an arc, so you can kind of tap into that. But, I think in truth, cricket now is probably better than it's ever been. I really do believe that. I think, you know, you look at the stats on test match results since 2000, you know, almost every game ends in a result now. Some people say that's not necessarily a good thing, but some of the greatest draws in test match cricket have happened in the modern era. the greatest tests in test history have probably happened in the modern era. So there is a kind of yearning for the past, and you always think, oh, I would love to have seen that. I think if you actually had to sit down and watch a test match from the 70s now, particularly in India maybe, you think, oh, what am I watching? I can't handle this. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's it's a persuasive argument to say things are always better in the past, but I'm not actually sure they were. I think, now is a great and golden age.
I think you made a really interesting point about Test cricket, because particularly with England, you look back at sort of great all-time England tests, and so many of them seem to have been in the last decade. I mean,
Sort
of following up on that, you've written some really interesting stuff recently on 2020, and I thought it was quite interesting because there's quite a knee-jerk reaction amongst kind of cricket fans who are really passionate about the test game to kind of write 2020 off. And what I enjoyed reading is you kind of made the case that recently, particularly made this case about the role specialist wicket keepers have played. And I thought, do you think that 2020's got sort of a bit more nuance, a bit more going on than it's being given credit for?
Well, I think a lot more. I mean, I think first of all, like when it came along, I loved it because as a kid, that's what you used to play. When you first started playing cricket, you played 20 overs a side. And when you were like 11, it seemed so long, 20 overs seemed that. Now, what I like about the sort of the emergence of 2020 since 2003 is that you can see people working it out and it's not been exhausted. I mean, I think the great argument against 50 over cricket is that it has become an exhausted form. There's nothing in it that happens that hasn't happened before. There's nothing that people don't know about how to play it. They've completely worked it out. Whereas 2020 has actually revolutionised the way the game is played in a way that 50 over cricket never quite did. I'm thinking in terms of, batting. Now, before 2003, I remember one thing I did a while ago, which was a great thing, which was when I met the guy who invented Merlin, the bowling machine. Oh. This wonderful old guy called Henry Pryor, and he invented this brilliant machine that could bowl anything. And one of the discussions we had at the time, this must have been, it was probably 2005, so 2020 was going, but it sort of shows you how quickly it's emerged. We had this long conversation about whether it was possible or not to hit a shot behind the wicketkeeper, because that was the one area of the field that no one had exploited. And it seemed obvious that someone was going to do it, but no one could really work out how. And then, of course, Dilshan came along, and now you've got people like Josh Butler, who not only do it, but, just work out what side of the wicketkeeper they want to flick it, and they do it off, it's been done off Lasith Malinga. That's what I mean about the way 2020 cricket has changed the game.
I think one thing I found really interesting is the way that there was, I remember when it first kind of came onto the scene, there was this feeling that spin bowlers in particular were just going to have this horrendous time of it. And they've ended up, their sort of guile has ended up dominating the format in a way.
You think, and that goes back to that point of, it's like cricket is, if you want to look at cricket, it's like sort of the inside of a watch, and you can't take one part out or move one part without moving a load of other parts. And if you look at the emergence of spin bowling and spinners opening the bowling, then you get someone like Michael Bates, who comes along, keeps wicket for Hampshire, who now stands up not just to spin bowlers but to everyone, because his position is a reaction to everything else that's happened in the game. Batsmen want to move forward, so we're going to stop that. How do we stop that? We're going to have a guy who can stand up to the stumps in all circumstances. So every little kind of cog turns and affects another cog. And that's what's fascinating about 2020 and the way it's changing the game.
No, I think it's really, I enjoyed hearing you now make the case for it, because I think too often you get people who, there's this idea, test cricket is kind of beautiful, complicated, interesting, 2020.
Which it is,
it does seem like you can kind of have both of them. And sort of...
I really don't see why you don't. And, the skill involved in, people talk about, it's just belting sixes. Well, it's a great skill to be able to do that. Equally, it's a great skill to, the test match going on at the moment between Australia and South Africa. You'll never beat that notion that, Australia, who've been essentially terrible for two and a half days or whatever it was, now are the only team who can win the game.
That's the
great kind of paradox of cricket, that they're the only ones who can now win. You'll never beat that, and you'll never beat the kind of great pace and drama of test cricket. But 2020's really got something. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
There's one question I have to ask. I try and ask everyone that comes on. Is you're put in charge of the ICC. You kind of have total control over the rules of the game, the organisation of the game. What would be your first move? I mean, what would be your kind of way to improve the game?
I would have to take a drastic step because I'll probably only get one chance at it. And I would abolish 50-over cricket.
You've written on this recently, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, I really did. The more I think about it, the more I think, you know, it's played out. It should have ended with MS Dhoni's 6 in Mumbai to win the World Cup for India. That if it had ended there, it would have been like a Hollywood script, and it would have been perfect. And we said, right, now we move on. We're playing 2020, and we're playing Test cricket. All of a sudden, the calendar's freed up. There's room to do everything that you want to do. There's room for all the exciting stuff in the game. And what 50-over cricket has never overcome is this sort of dead period in the middle. Once the power plays are over, to the last few overs, everyone knows what's going to happen, and it's impossible to overcome that. And I don't think they will overcome that, because no one's thought of a way of overcoming it so far.
And there have been so many attempts, haven't there?
They have. They've fiddled with everything. And, you know, they've even had substitutes. They've tried everything, and they will not overcome that. And, yes, the people who argue for it say, well, you get a great day out, and you get this sort of occasion, you get this great drama at the end, which you sort of periodically do, but... You know, I still don't think it's a strong enough argument than the fact that it's clogging up the schedules. Great, huge amounts of the games are terribly boring. They're open to fixing. It's getting to the point where it's doing more harm than good, I think. And I would, at a stroke, get rid of it.
I just want, the other issue I seem to have more and more with 50-over cricket is, whereas every test series England are involved in really feels like an event, a lot of the one-day series now, I almost can't remember who's won after, they just don't.
You really can't. And worse than that, you can't remember who's won. It doesn't matter who's won. No. That's the other thing. You know, it really doesn't matter who's won. And I know, you know, other people might say, oh, well, England have never been any good at it, which is a great point. They have never been any good at it. But essentially, you know, I just get the feeling that across the world, it's sort of, you know, the players don't enjoy it that much. If they speak about the treadmill, I think that's what they're talking about.
And finally, to the debate. And this week, we're asking whether Twitter has enriched the cricket viewing experience.
A couple of years ago, we're told that it was Twitter that caused the revolution in Egypt and the beginning of the Arab Spring, bringing together millions of like-minded people and allowing them a forum in which to share ideas and to create a kind of new community. And perhaps it's going a little bit far to say that a similar thing has happened with...
I think it's certainly going a little
with,
too far.
With cricket.
I mean, way too far.
But I think that... One of the things that is quite nice about Twitter is that so when you go onto Twitter when there's a big game happening, there's a real sense that it's the only place, and I can't think of any other way, in which you can kind of create a community of people from all different kinds of backgrounds and from, you know, for instance, Indian fans and England fans and fans from all over the world coming together on a single point. And what it does is that it takes away from it does two things. It takes away from the traditional authority of commentators. So you don't just have Test Match Special or the Sky Sports commentary team telling you what's going on. You've got a real range of different voices coming together.
I must admit, I like your idea of a community, and I'm staggered with the boldness of your Arab Spring analogy. But... there's a nice idea of a community around the game. I've spent a lot of time on Twitter this week. It's kind of provoked this debate, using the much underused reverse radio feed for a change. And my main issue is that it is a quality one. And the vast quantity of Twitter is unfortunately dross.
You can choose who you follow. You can.
And the problem with following the India-England feed this week, which is going to be my main thing, and I agree, that's not a filter. It's filtered in the sense it's anyone who's commenting on India-England, is the sheer repetition of it. So, on the first day of the test, I read Monty should have been picked phrased in perhaps 250 different ways.
Yeah.
You know, the extent to which people felt the need to repeat, and I thought, well, this isn't adding anything. And the sense of what you're kind of saying, the sense of kind of amateur punditry, it was just amateur in the negative sense.
But the point is not that you sit there passively consuming what other people are saying. It's all about engaging with what other people are saying and being able to actually have things that go back. Mm. And you choose those kind of debates that go back and forth. And it's actually all about changing models. I mean, Twitter more generally is about changing models in the media, which is moving away from the quite hierarchical way that organisations dictate to their audience things that they want to know and they think they want to know and they tell you what's right. What's nice about cricket is that it actually allows the kind of conversations that we have, albeit in 120 mm-hmm. characters. Maybe our conversations would be far more effective if they were held in 120 characters at a time. But it allows these kind of conversations, which is all, you know, which is what cricket is about. It's all about the debates that happen.
So I would agree with you. There are moments, and I've had these moments this week, where you engage on Twitter with someone from the other side of the world, who's quite, you know, quite sharp on the issue, and you have quite an interesting discussion. I think there's another slightly odd point here, though, I do occasionally find, that you've got people who are tweeting frantically and continually while watching the game. And I sometimes think that there's something attention deficit disorder about this. I mean, if you really want to engage with something, you know, whether it be a film, a play, a book, you just engage with it. That's the sort of entirety of attention. And I was guilty of that this week, that I found myself tweeting and I thought, God, I'm tweeting and I'm following my Twitter feed more than I'm following the game. And I think that's a real danger.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are two things. One of which is that Twitter doesn't become a substitute for watching the game. And what I find really annoying is people who tweet, you know, cooks out and think, well,
yeah,
if I wanted to know exactly what was happening in the cricket, I'd be on the Cricket Info feed. Yeah. And I don't want updates on it. And absolutely, there has to be an element of sort of self-regulation about it. But actually, I think there's something that is very much about engaging with this is, by the way, I work in arts marketing and so talk a lot about sort of engaging,
the joys of Twitter.
engaging with experiences and engaging particularly with artistic experiences, but there's something very important about being able to engage with other people around that. Art does not happen in isolation. Following cricket does not happen in isolation. You're right. One of millions of people.
So I guess, in a sense, it's a contract. You could say it's not quite parallel, but it's maybe the difference between going to a day of cricket on your own, which actually can be great fun, or going with your mates, you know, yeah, where you obviously have a totally different experience again. I think we can both agree on the fact that if done selectively and positively, there are some good things to get out of it. I do just feel, though, that there's a danger. There's a danger, I think, that sometimes comes that this is this new, well, it's not even that new anymore, this exciting form of technology, and suddenly the need that certain news organisations have in particular to kind of give us, to re-quote endless Twitter, I find a little bit frustrating. I think in some ways it's being given a sort of importance by certain organisations that it maybe doesn't have because of this quality issue. You know, there is a need to constantly quality control it. Otherwise, you're often just given a kind of, without sounding too derogatory, kind of a mob voice almost, you know.
Now, we hasten to add, despite the fact that Andy thinks any of you who are on Twitter are insufferable bores, we are on Twitter. Yeah. We're at Reverse Sweat.
Right now, we're tweeting constantly.
And we would be delighted to connect with you over there, so do go on and send us.
If you don't want to connect with us, you could just follow us.
That's us? Idea. You know, you can watch our inane ramblings. We'll be back in 3 weeks' time.
3 weeks' time for where we will report on several more England spin-related batting collapses.